seven bills this evening. First one we're going to consider is on the agenda is number two, Senate File 599, resolution to end trade and financial travel restrictions to Cuba. Thank you, Senator Vickerman and Senator Pappas, for bringing this forward. You may proceed.
Well, Mr. President, members of the committee, I bring before you a resolution that I feel we've probably waited too long, at least 40 years since we put the trade embargo on, and I'd like hope that we can get this committee and Congress to open that up to trade. It's important to me. I farm, and I know we can do that inner trade.
No, I'm fine.
I know there's food sales, medicine supplies, and I know for a fact that there's over $1 billion of food products and agri commodities moves back and forth to feed 11 million people. Mr. Chair and members, I have Senator Pappas with me to help a little bit. Then I have two young gentlemen that I'm going to ask to come up here, and they can tell you more than this older gentleman could tell you, because they've been there.
Well, we appreciate that. We always like to have
Mr. Chairman, while
younger folks up here. Senator.
While they're coming up here, I just want to make a few comments.
Oh, you're go ahead, Senator Pappas.
I actually have organized three legal trips to Cuba through the Augsburg College Center on Global Education. Our groups, there were educational groups and professional development, and our groups were able to move around Havana, visit communities outside Havana, attend religious services, meet with government officials and non-government officials, go out to dinner, visit museums, attend baseball games and other cultural events, and buy souvenirs. But since 2004, I've not been able to get a license to bring another group, even though there are a lot of people who would be interested in going. Not just educational and professional development trips have been denied, religious groups and Cuban-American family members have also been severely restricted. So the purpose of our resolution today is to Congress to urge them to lift the ban on travel and the restrictions on trade, as Senator Vickerman mentioned. It's in the best interest of U.S. citizens and the future of U.S. relations with Latin America to engage with Cuba rather than continue to isolate ourselves. I mean, we treat Cuba differently, even from remaining communist systems in China and Vietnam. The U.S. policy toward Cuba simply isn't rational, and we hope that the administration would join in Congress in having more flexibility in its interactions with Cuba and support Congress in repealing the Helms-Burton Act of 1996.
Good. Thank you very much. A couple of young folks here. You want to identify yourself for the tape.
Hello, my name is Seth Kaler, and this is my brother Cliff Kaler, and I'd personally like to thank you for your opportunity on allowing us to testify for the Cuban resolution. I am a sophomore at St. Charles High School, and the info and stats that you just got were put together by Craig Danstrom, and there are some photos on there that kind of just show what we did when we were down there. When we got involved with Cuba, my dad went over to China with Governor Ventura, and he asked everyone if they would be interested in going down to Cuba to do an expo. And, of course, my dad, being the person he is, had to volunteer. And what we brought down there, we brought what we were known as the Cuban Ark. We brought two beef, two dairy heifers, two pigs, two sheep, and two bison bottle calves. When we were down there, we had all the animals there, and we gave all the tours. We also made a lot of friends when we were down there, one of which I will always remember is with President Fidel Castro. And being just like me, he was raised on a farm and asked some knowledgeable questions. We also met some children down there that go around the world speaking on behalf of Cuba and what their
Seth, is this you?
Guys? The smaller one is me. The one with the spotted shirt, kind of.
He's a big tall guy, his brother.
Yep.
Sometimes.
Yeah, that's me.
All right.
Yeah, that's him.
You're about equal today, but go ahead. Yeah.
When we were down there, like I said, we met some children that go around the world speaking on behalf of them for their president. Each country also has stuff that both countries can get. We have corn, soybeans, wheat, and other agricultural products that Cuba could use for their animals and their people. But they also have how they use the organic materials and what they do for it. This resolution is a step forward in making a new friend and a trading partner. I'd like to thank you again for letting me testify.
Thank you very much.
My name is Cliff Kaler. I'm a senior at Cotter High School, and I'd like to thank you guys again for letting us testify. If a basketball coach had a losing record for 40 years and never changed his strategy, he'd be out of a job. That is the same philosophy behind the Cuban embargo. The stated goal has been regime change, and yet through that there have been dozens of dictators prior to the embargo in Latin and South America, and Fidel Castro was the only one who stayed through the whole time, and he was the only one that there was an embargo put on. Lifting the embargo will help U.S., Cuba, and it is in place because of old politics. How will it help the U.S.? We have the potential for $1 billion worth of egg trade a year. Currently, they're our top 15 trading partners, and prior to the embargo being put on, they were our number one trading partner. We just met with a Cuban official at the embassy or the foreign office in Washington, D.C., and they're currently doing research on a vaccine that stops cancer tumors, essentially killing the cancer. The testing is being done, and it has been very successful. They have a powerful cholesterol-lowering drug, PPG. They have fruit, and they have oil reserves off their shores. We will trade with them beef, dairy, DDGs, powdered milk, and many other agricultural products that will directly affect us in Minnesota. Cuba has said that once the embargo is lifted, they will buy 100,000 cattle from the U.S. And I did a research paper on this, and every single one said that there will be thousands of jobs created both in the Midwest and down in Miami if the Cuban embargo is lifted. And the biggest reason, we will have a friend 90 miles off our shore, not an enemy. How will it help Cuba? They will have the largest economy in the world to trade with that now is 90 miles off their shore, and they can hardly do any business with them. Cuba is a tourist-based economy. Many experts say that 1 million Americans will travel down to Cuba each year once the embargo is lifted. That will be an influx of hundreds of millions of dollars into the Cuban economy. Right now, their animals on their egg farms are stagnant. They have not had any new genetics, and their feed is old, 40 years old. With us, they will get new genetics and new feed. Their dairy cows are two-thirds the size of our dairy cows because they do not have the source of protein that is needed for them to grow. The Cuban embargo is in place because of old politics. Florida has 27 electoral votes. You do the math, that's a lot more than Minnesota and Iowa. The hardline exiles in Miami represent the swing vote in the swing state of Florida. If Al Gore had won that state, he would be president now. Most Cuban Americans actually favor lifting the embargo, but the vocal ones do not favor it because they are the ones that have a vested interest if the embargo is lifted. They own the huge fruit companies, the sugar sultans down in Cuba, or in Florida. That is why they don't want it lifted. We met over a dozen Cuban Americans in Florida, from taxi drivers to hotel attendants, and every single one of them wanted the embargo to lifted, and they left not because of Fidel Castro, but because of the economy down there is not good. In conclusion, we know who voting for this resolution will represent, but I really do have to question if you vote against this resolution, who are you representing? Because all the benefits are for us. It's just a few select down in Miami who this would hurt. I know you guys don't like resolutions, but I feel this is an extremely important thing for us to vote on because it'll give Minnesota a voice and it'll give us a direction on a national policy. And Einstein once said, problems cannot be solved with the same thinking that created them, so let's end the Cuban embargo, or make a resolution. Thank you.
Thank you. Good, very good. Any questions, Senator Day?
Mr. Chairman, and I have no problem voting for the resolution, but in somebody that had a condo for 11 years on the 79th Street Causeway, the John F. Kennedy Causeway in a little town called North Bay Village, I've had numerous Cuban cigars and I've drank a lot of beer. And I will tell you what, I think maybe the story that you're telling sounds good, but it doesn't sound good to the Cuban people that live in the United States. I will tell you, they will tell you about the atrocities and the reason that they all vote different and like the embargo and feel that we're actually forcing this company, country. But I can vote for the resolution, but I would be glad to share with you some of the friends that I gained and have their input to how they feel about it, which is quite a bit different than everything is fine and dandy and we should do trade. So There is another story. I don't have a problem with the resolution, but trust me, there's hundreds of thousands of Cubans in Little Havana and all over that area that wouldn't agree I don't know if they would agree with what we're doing because it's a federal government issue, but they probably would look at it a little bit different than we're probably.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Day, it really just is a matter of strategy, is what's going to influence Cuba more to change and become part of the international community and solve some of their human rights issues and their democratic freedom issues. Is it an embargo that we've had for 40 years that hasn't really done anything? Or is it engagement? Is it trade? Is it interaction? Is it tourism? Is it allowing family members to go back and forth to Cuba every year except every 3 years? So that's really the difference. I've observed that Cuba has changed, and they no longer discriminate against religion. Religion is now, you're free to practice your religion in Cuba. They no longer discriminate against gays. They have more opening in terms of culture, film. They have a film, international film festival. But there are still problems, for sure. But it doesn't mean that the problems reach the level of an embargo.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, that's a resolution that we hope that Congress will take seriously and look to see how we can take care of some of the problems that Senator Day has. I like Cuban cigars myself. I want to get to smoke them when I'm fishing because my wife won't let me do it when I'm home. But I don't drink beer, so that doesn't do any good. Mm-hmm. But, I want to thank these two young guys here. This is the future of this country, right here. And this will happen. You'll get a little older, but it'll happen. Because I think big government is also looking at, we've had this embargo long enough. We should take a look at it. So all we're trying to do is tell Congress that to look at it, and you know they'll look at it, and then maybe it won't happen like tomorrow, but it'll happen in time. I'm sure of that. So, Mr. Chair, if there's nothing else.
Wait, Senator Carlson.
I'm also for this resolution. I think it's way beyond time for us to open up the trade, but there is a practical problem, and I'm an engineer. I'm not a lawyer. And so maybe some lawyer can remember a little bit better than me. I do have a good memory that there is a law that allows reparations to be collected from companies that do business with Cuba or in Cuba with land or companies that have been nationalized under their present government. When NAFTA was signed, that also extended to the NAFTA countries. And there actually was a family from Florida that sued a sugar company in Canada who was doing business with a sugar organization in Cuba that had taken over that family's plantation. So, and I can't remember the name of it. It's like it's named after the two lawmakers that actually passed it, and that needs to be repealed. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, we've had Vietnam has come and gone. Now their most favored nation, China, all sorts of countries that we're now trading with, and Cuba is a natural. We should be opening that back up. But there is that practical problem, and that has to be taken care of.
Okay, I don't know if that's more of a statement than I think Senator Carlson is probably on something there. Any, Senator Pappas, are you awake? You're doing good? Yeah. Senator Vickerman?
Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion on Senator Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate File 599 be recommended to pass and refer to Senate floor.
They have to go to Rules Committee? So told it has to go to Rules Committee. Any further discussion on Senator Murphy's motion? Seeing none, all isn't. Further discussion from anybody in the audience? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion prevails. Senator Vickerman, are you ready on your second
Thank you, resolution? Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate File 886 is an immigration reform resolution. I suppose you probably wonder why I'm carrying this piece of legislation, but if you live in southern Minnesota where I live, we have a lot of minorities, a lot of immigrants that work in the Swift plant. The schools are 60 to 70% immigrants down where I live. So I thought I would be more than willing to carry the bill. And it's a resolution, actually, is what it is, Mr. Chair, and we just memorialized the President and Congress to promote the United States' ability to compete in global marketplace with talented and necessary workers. Whereas immigration policy is set at the federal level, but the actual benefits and challenges of immigration are felt at the state and local levels. Mr. President, members of the Senate, and members of this committee, the President is also looking at immigration laws to see how we can move those laws forward. All this resolution does is try to give them a look at Minnesota is ready to help if you need help on figuring how to get these rules put together. And I have two people here that could speak probably better than I could to this issue, Mr. President, if that would be okay.
That'd be fine, yeah. You have John Keller and Susie Brown. Who wants us, Mr. Keller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Keller. I'm the Executive Director of the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota. I've been an attorney for 10 years. Our office represents people throughout the metro area in southern Minnesota and had we were called down and worked for the last 8 years in Worthington as well as after the December 12th raids and continue there to this day working with the after effects. First of all, thank you, Senators, for inviting me. The immigration system, the federal immigration system in the United States is broken. There's bipartisan agreement that that is true. There's an estimated 12 million undocumented immigrants in the United States. The estimates are unclear in Minnesota, but a ballpark, it seems most people agree, around perhaps 80,000. Maybe 40% of them entered legally with visas. Again, a bipartisan agreement on that. The other reality is that for low-skilled workers, people who are not professionals coming from India or the East, there are 5,000 visas allotted per year. An estimated 500,000 jobs for low-skilled immigrants are created every year. There is no legal path for the folks who are currently here or those who would like to enter with a legal visa to do that. This resolution is extremely timely at this point. Approximately 3 weeks ago, we were in Washington, and we met with 9 out of 10 of our federal delegates in Washington around immigration reform. The STRIVE bill had just been introduced by Representative Gutierrez and Jeff Flake, a Republican from Arizona, calling for comprehensive immigration reform. I have the 697-page bill in my briefcase, but I won't.
Would you pull that out?
I won't bore you with it.
Read that to us.
What I will say to you, and I'll be very – I'll try to wrap up because, of course, this is a very important issue to me and to our clients, is that it is an attempt – to fix all aspects of immigration reform. It's an attempt to fix the border. It's an attempt to fix new flows of people coming in with work visas. And it's also an attempt through a series of requirements, including a payment of a hefty fine, background checks, to legalize the folks not only in Minnesota but across the United States who are here in an undocumented fashion. So the time is now. The other important thing for you all to be aware of, I'm sure it's intuitive, but we brought along a package of materials that we left behind with our federal delegates and their staffers, and included in them were copies of this resolution. And they were all very interested to know whether or not the state of Minnesota was going to support it and whether or not that was something that they could use, particularly in districts where making any votes on immigration is a difficult vote. So the fact that resolutions, even though, you know, this is a resolution saying it's a federal problem and the federal system is broken, have no power to change things, they actually do have a captive audience, I'd say, at this point with our federal delegates, and they are interested, and it will make a difference in some particular races. So I'd be more than happy to answer any questions either now or when we finish. Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll hear from Ms. Brown, and then we'll take questions. Ms. Brown.
Thank you. My name is Susie Brown. I'm the Public Policy Director at Family and Children's Service, which is a nonprofit organization located in Minneapolis. I'm here today to just make a very brief remark on behalf of the Affirm Coalition. We are a coalition of organizations that include faith, labor, business, immigrants, nonprofits, and the legal community, and we're working together on a number of proposals at the state level which would improve the lives and circumstances of immigrants in Minnesota. And while we're working very hard on these issues and we're very dedicated to them, we realize that the work that we're doing in Minnesota is really working around the edges of a very important federal issue that needs to be resolved in order to fix the broken system. So we strongly support this resolution. We see this as the first and most important step in solving some of the complex immigration problems in Minnesota, and we ask for your support. Thank you.
Well, Mr. President, I just mentioned my home area, Worthington, but if I look around here, I can see where there are our immigrant workers, Senator Rose and Senator Gimsey, all through the whole area. We need the workers. We just have to have them in that SWIFT plant. They process 18,000 hogs a day, and it runs constantly. I've visited. I've walked on that line. I wouldn't work there. You couldn't pay me enough to work in there. That's hard work, very hard work, and they're very dedicated. Some of them get a bad name about the ICE, that ICC that comes in there. I will tell you this. I could have went right down to that SWIFT plant myself. And I could have called them into a room like this, and I could have talked to everyone. I didn't need a club. I didn't need a gun. I didn't need handcuffs. That was way out of line. Now, there are some bad people, but there are bad people everywhere. So what we want to do with Congress, and I think the timing is getting right, that we have to do something with immigrants because they're going to be coming in. We all come here. And my dad, and it was a German. I couldn't speak a German word if you asked me to. My wife is a Carlson, Swede. They come over here and they Carlson? Couldn't even talk in the church. They had to change it. So.
Hey, Senator, you might be Carlson's brother or cousin or something here.
Huh? So, Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's any more questions. I know you're pressed for time, and I thank you for allowing me to at least, and I think this is something we need to work on.
Senator Rosen, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Senator Vickerman. So by passing the resolution, will that spur the Congress, the federal legislation? They are asking for us to move on some kind of resolution at the state level so they can continue on their work. Is that what I'm understanding?
Senator Rosen, it's just like anything else. If you get some support, it's a lot easier to pass something. Mm-hmm. And I've met with them. I was out to Washington. The Ag Committee went out there, and I talked to them about this issue. But all the agriculture chairs in the United States were out there. They all know there's a problem. They all know we want to work on it. It's not going to come overnight. Even the President of the United States is also trying to figure out a way to do it. It's just something that we need to move ahead on, and I think it's great that Minnesota, we always pride ourselves in being the leader, and we can lead in this.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Michelle.
We just slipped these resolutions in Dick Day's side. In his breast pocket. He's going to be going out there in January.
January?
Next year, I guess.
You know,
we can save the stamp.
It's April now.
Save the stamp.
We're going to be a little late.
You are a troublemaker.
700 days going out in January, and now it's April.
Is there a NASCAR race out there?
Trying to go
out.
All right, any further discussion on Senate File 886, Senator Vickerman? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just support this. I think we need to make some action in this whole issue. We're all waiting for the feds to do something. But
Senator Rosen.
Yes, I would like to move that Senate File 886 be
recommended to pass.
Recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor.
Rules.
And let's go to Rules Committee.
Thank you.
On the Rosen motion, further discussion, anybody in the audience? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
You're welcome. You had a good night, huh? 2-for-2, Senator Vickerman. Senator Anderson, get back to your
resolution. Excuse me. He has a resolution, too.
It's a resolution or no, it's more than that.
This would be a law. We're interested in a law.
Yeah, I think we've heard from the, I believe, the proponents. Is that correct? And now we're going to hear from the opponents, if that's agreeable with the members of the committee. And maybe we don't need... Mr. David Dietrich and Kevin Matzik, welcome to the committee, and you may identify yourselves and tell us who you're with.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Kevin Matzik. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Restaurant Association. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. I would like to address the committee on an issue that's vital to the survival of full-service restaurants in Minnesota, which is the issue of server wages. A server wage is a wage paid to a tipped employee that is less than the minimum wage, with the understanding that their tips will pay their will place their wage above the minimum wage. If ever the tips do not make up the difference between the server wage and the minimum wage, the employer would be required to make up the difference. Minnesota is one of only seven states that does not recognize tips as wages and allow for a server wage. 43 other states, the District of Columbia and the federal government, all recognize tips as wages and allow for a server wage. If you look at the regional map, I believe it was handed out earlier today, you can see what the server wages are for the surrounding states. And you'll see that Minnesota requires restaurants to pay tipped employees 2 to 3 times more than our surrounding states. If this bill passes, the minimum wage increases to $7.75 an hour without a server wage. Minnesota will be paying its servers $5 more per hour than Wisconsin. And that difference amounts to a huge competitive disadvantage for Minnesota restaurants and will result in fewer and fewer restaurants opening in our state. Minnesota restaurants already operate on a small profit margin. 4% profit means you're doing pretty well in the industry, and many are struggling to make a profit. Labor costs amount to approximately 35% of total costs, and the minimum wage increase would result in a 26% increase in tipped employees' wages, which would reduce the already low profit margins by half. Also, this is an issue of fairness. When the minimum wage increases without allowing for a server wage, you're in fact giving a raise to the highest compensated employees in the restaurant, while those who could use an increase receive next to nothing. In a survey of our members, the average in this bar graph here shows the results from our survey of our members, shows the average wage for a tipped employee in Minnesota was nearly $20 an hour. These are the folks who are going to see a $1.60 increase per hour with this bill, while the hostesses, bussers, dishwashers, who average around $8 an hour, would receive nothing. Just to briefly comment, Senator Anderson, I know, brought up the deeds numbers that show an average wage for his servers in the state from Deed's numbers is about $6.88 an hour. And I'm working with Deed to look into those numbers. I don't dispute what Deed is putting on their website, but the numbers don't really add up. If you're a server making $6.15 an hour and you wait on one table that with an average ticket of $10, and that one table tips you 15% on that one table, that's $1.50. So you're up to $7.65 an hour. So you're already above the $6.88 number that was quoted on the Deed website. Mr. Chair and members, you all know the hospitality industry is a cornerstone of the Minnesota economy. There's nearly 250,000 jobs, making up almost 9% of the state's economy. Last year, the hospitality industry saw a 3.9% increase in jobs, which is good, but unfortunately, full-service restaurants did not enjoy the same growth. The 2005 minimum wage increase hurt the full-service restaurant segment hard. In 2006, for the first time in over 17 years, full-service segment lost jobs. It's an industry that had averaged 4, 5, 6% growth in jobs every year. But in 2006, there was an actual loss in jobs. Restaurant growth in Minnesota is occurring in the counter-service or quick-service businesses. And there's nothing wrong with growth in the quick service restaurant industry. They're good businesses. They're an important part of the economy, and they meet the growing consumer demand for quick meals and a fast-paced lifestyle. But the tipped employee jobs in the restaurant industry are the highly desirable jobs. They offer flexibility of schedule that many people desire, whether they're working moms and dads or school-aged young adults. These jobs offer an excellent wage to the employees. They're the very jobs that will continue to disappear if this minimum wage increase is passed without a server wage provision. We're asking the legislature to exempt tipped employees from the minimum wage increase and recognize that tips are wages, as 43 other states and the federal government do. Tips are considered wages for federal tax purposes, state tax purposes, Social Security, and unemployment insurance. It is time that the state again recognize tips as wages for determining minimum wage. Mr. Chair, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Matzik. David Diederichs from the Minnesota Chamber.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is David Diederichs from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thanks for the opportunity today to talk about Senate File 875. Mr. Chair and members, the Minnesota Chamber supports keeping Minnesota's minimum wage at its current level and ultimately maintaining our state minimum wage with the federal level. Currently, there is legislation at the federal level that would raise the minimum wage from $5.15 an hour to $7.25 an hour over the next 2 years. Not only would this legislation in front of you dramatically increase Minnesota's current minimum wage levels, but the legislation's inclusion of an annual index inflation factor would also greatly accelerate levels. Ultimately, we believe this could harm the number of jobs available, and it could also adversely affect prices of both goods and services. Just a few statistics, Mr. Chair. According to the Minnesota Department of Labor in 2005, and this is the most recent data available, approximately 83,000 workers in the state were making $6.15 an hour or less. Now, this is down from 119,000 in 2003 before the last minimum wage change. From 1998 to 2003, the percentage of workers making $6.15 an hour or less in Minnesota's workforce has dropped from 11% to 3.3%, which is a 70% decrease. The number of minimum wage workers has dropped in all major demographic categories and in all occupational groups, signaling that the market has increased wages throughout the economy. The Chamber believes an increase in the minimum wage is not necessary because the market increases wages for employees. Employee productivity gains have been rewarded with increased wages, and the demand for labor will ensure that gains are maintained and expanded in the future. I would also just like to briefly mention that the Chamber does support the tip credit that Mr. Matzek was just talking about, and just conclude that, again, the Chamber opposes this legislation. We would like to see Minnesota's levels consistent with the federal law changes. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions of the witnesses?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Letts.
Thank you. Mr. Matzik, I had trouble following one part of your argument, which was the suggestion that a differential with our neighboring states is going to cause a loss of business, except maybe along some communities right at the border. I mean, I've driven from St. Louis Park to Stillwater to have dinner because I like Phil's Terra Hideaway a lot, but I haven't driven from St. Louis Park to Madison just for dinner. Anyway, do you have any evidence to suggest that other than a community along, I don't think St. Louis Park's going to lose a lot of restaurant business because we've got a differential with Wisconsin. Do you have any evidence to suggest otherwise?
Actually, Mr. Chair and sure. Senator Letts, where you see the biggest effect on that is with the bigger chain restaurants. When they do their calculation of where to open up a new restaurant. They only have the capital to open up so many restaurants a year. And speaking with one Minnesota chain, they had recently had the opportunity to open up a restaurant in Minnesota and a restaurant in Illinois. And when they went through all of the costs, the land costs was about the same, the construction costs were about the same, but it was the labor costs was so much greater in Minnesota than it was in Illinois. That chain decided to open up their restaurant in Illinois and did not open one in Minnesota.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tabasoni.
On the flip side, all the waiters and waitresses in all these other states are going to come to Minnesota to work.
Oh, that's a good
Hey.
God, you're quick. I tell you that
it's actually happened in North Dakota and South Dakota. They've actually lost workforce to Minnesota because Minnesota actually pays them to work.
Mr. Chair.
Not to mention, where in the heck were you guys during the smoking ban debate when I needed you to say we're going to lose all kinds of jobs as a result of the smoking ban?
You don't have to answer that.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I will agree to your point that on those border communities, you do see the better. You will have a more qualified labor force coming into Minnesota. You'd be silly not to drive in.
And that's not a bad thing.
No, absolutely not. But I think the counter to that, though, is as we continue to increase the server wage, as we saw in 2006, the jobs are going to start going away in Minnesota, and then those jobs won't be here.
Well, you know, Mr. Chairman, I've been hearing this for 15 years, and it hasn't happened. It's really interesting how Minnesota just keeps growing, and we keep hearing these doom and gloom things. And
Mr. Chair,
keeps getting better. In fact,
Senator,
we have 17 Fortune 500 companies.
19.
Just 19? You said 19.
19.
Fortune 500 companies within the Twin Cities area.
That's
and we've
down.
We've been hearing how bad Minnesota's business climate is all these years. It's the largest number in this size metropolitan area in the United States.
Senator Michelle.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and I guess somewhat in response to my friend, Senator Tomasoni, but, you know, I don't know if it's doom and gloom, but, you know, you do get into, and Senator Anderson kind of opened up her remarks with the economic statistics and the battle of do you gain, do you lose, what happens in border communities. And, you know, I don't have the definitive study. I got an email the other day from a restaurant owner in the western suburbs, and he just said, look, here's what happened in 2005 when the state raised the minimum wage. He had to lay off 3 employees. He had to raise prices about 5%. So I don't know if that's doom and gloom, but there's definitely a cause and an effect. And I believe it's a cause and effect that's harmful.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In response, Senator Tomasoni, to those Fortune 500 companies, it would be interesting, I don't have the figures in front of me, to see where their expansion is going. And I can guess and venture that it's not expanding in Minnesota. They started here. They're committed to Minnesota, but I think I'd be very correct in saying that a lot of the expansion is out of the state.
Okay. Further discussion on the bill.
Thank you.
Senator Scoy, would you care to move the bill or somebody?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Michelle, before...
If there's some general discussion. Senator Anderson, I think... Well, first of all, I want to applaud you for... You're just tenacious. Every 2 years.
No, she's Lutheran. Oh, tenacious, yeah.
Every 2 years,
Presbyterian.
I think.
Presbyterian, that's close. Yeah.
Well, and I think probably everyone at this table, and I know you and I share the same goal of how do we grow Minnesota? How do we get good jobs to come here and to stay here? And so that your two boys and my four girls have a great future in a great economy. And I'm in a different place than you on this issue. And I come down against this bill. I appreciated the statistics that you shared on really what this means for each Senate district, but you know, we're not Santa Claus. We can't give raises. Right? The only group we can give raises to is ourselves, and we already did that, ironically. But you know, Mr. Chair, this is the Senate Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee. Business and industry oppose this, and I think it's going to be harmful for jobs. So I hope members will think long and hard about this bill today.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson,
Senator Michelle, I think you're pretty tenacious as well, and You didn't give up.
Also Presbyterian.
Presbyterian, yeah.
Also Presbyterian. We didn't know that. So.
Jews.
We're Mephitic.
And you, were persistently opposed to this bill 2 years ago, and didn't think it would pass, for that matter, I believe. And I think the question I would pose to you is, has our economy fallen apart in the last 2 years? Have our jobs all fled the state in the last 2 years? I don't really think there's any evidence of that. And I do think that we're actually far from, becoming a place that's going to push these kinds of jobs away. We're in danger of being out of the mainstream on this issue, believe it or not, even though it's only been 2 years, because states around the nation are realizing that this is such an important fundamental issue for government to lead on to help its citizens. And that's why, as I said at the beginning, half the states are already ahead of us on their minimum wages. And so, if we start to get below average in the wages that the workers in our state are paid, I think that puts us on a downward spiral because, yes, we want to have good jobs, we want to have good businesses, and we want to have people who work in our state who can afford to take care of themselves and their families, or we're going to see the consequences here in the Capitol every day, and we're going to have more people who can't afford their health insurance, more people who can't afford just to pay for the basic needs and to support those children.
Mr. Chair.
So we need to look out for our constituents.
And just to continue the discussion a little bit, Senator Anderson, I would join you in a heartbeat on locking in Minnesota's minimum wage with the federal minimum wage. I think that makes a lot of sense. I'm very concerned about us being an island of high costs. I'm very concerned about what that does. And I think there are some warning signs in today's economy. I do think there are some alarm bells going off. The biggest that I can think of off the top of my head is we're fourth from the bottom in per capita income growth now. We're hurting a little bit. And so I do think these kind of measures enacted by the state government can hurt business, can hurt jobs, and can hurt the economy.
This is all about raising incomes. That's exactly what this is about.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Day.
I wasn't going to get into this discussion, but what the heck. It's waking me up, so I think I might have to. First off, I don't think it's government's business to set any kind of minimum wage. Never have, never will. I don't think it should be $2 or $10 or $80. I just don't agree with that. But let me just tell you three things that have happened to me in the last 2 days. First off, today I got an email from the mayor of Owatonna that told me that minimum wage is being here today, that Ruby Tuesdays is not coming to Owatonna because of minimum wage bill. Okay? So that's Owatonna, that's one employer. This morning I had breakfast with one of the largest contractors in the state of Minnesota, and he told me business is good outside the state of Minnesota. The vacancy rate is like 20% in Bloomington. It's like 18% in downtown Minneapolis. He's an individual that builds hospitals and medical stuff. He said it's absolutely. And last night at 4 o'clock at Caribou out in Wayzata, a guy laughed at me and threw his new driver's license from Naples, Florida, that lived in a multi-million-dollar home, run a multi-million-dollar company, and he now lives in Naples, and he has his home in Naples. And he told everybody in Caribou Coffee. That was three in just the last 24 hours or 48 hours. I told the mayor that, the Democrats are now running the Minnesota Senate and the House, and why do I want to get involved? But I'm doing it, as you're seeing right now. I'm getting involved, but that's just my Irish in me. So I got to jump in and wait around a little bit, even though that I have no chance at all. But the federal government, the guy down in
my district ran on minimum wage, telling everybody, you elect me, I get minimum wage. January 1st, he said, we're going to put minimum wage in the federal government. It's now, I don't know what it is now. And if the federal government, they're under control there, why don't they do it and get it done with? I don't think President Bush has said he wouldn't sign it if they get it to him. So they've been lollygagging around now for 3 months. And here we sit in Minnesota. Now we're going to take up all our valuable time, and maybe it won't be, maybe it isn't valuable, but hopefully it is, discussing something that's now going to be higher than the federal government. It makes absolutely no sense to me, but I will keep moving on here because I realize where I'm at and who's running things, and I know what's going to happen. But if you think that you can have one right after another of all of these things that are happening with all the taxes and changing all the laws and all the labor unions that are coming forward in this committee night, day in and day out, and everything is going to be the same, I think you're wrong. And I think in a year or two from now, you're going to see some real repercussions. And I don't think people are going to say we're going to build here. Why would they? This is a big country. They have a lot of places they can build. So it isn't a doom and gloom or anything. I think it's going to be business practices by people that make a living in expanding businesses and building businesses and making money and employing people. And that's it.
Well,
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, go ahead.
Senator Gimsey. I appreciate your efforts here, and I see that we increased the minimum wage a couple of years ago in the state of Minnesota, and I'm not going to support this legislation to increase it again in this short a period of time. But I do want to note something that on what you handed out on the local impact. In my Senate district, you show that jobs that are paying $775 or less was $5,759, or 15% of the workforce. I guess what I would prefer to see is how many jobs are at $675, since the $775 is the big corporations, which I don't have a lot of. I've got a lot of small businesses and, small businesses that are going to be affected by this, and not large corporations that are going to pay that are going to be required to pay the $775, but rather the $675. I too have gotten calls from restaurant owners that are concerned about this. We had the discussion during the smoking ban about the margins that our small restaurants and bars are working on, and my good friend Senator Thomasoni at the time said that the smoking ban was going to cause a problem with his small bars and restaurants, and how we can't see that this is going to have a detrimental effect on our small bars and restaurants also if we don't implement at least a tax credit on this thing. I guess I fail to understand.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gimsey, I'm just looking at your Senate district here, and this data came from Deed, and they did include, and I'm not sure if this is on your sheet or not, but they did include in their information the number of jobs below $6.15 an hour, so the ones that are, less than or equal to $6.15, and those less than $7.75. So if you look at the less than $6.15 an hour, those are the ones, a lot of that will be the small business ones under the current law, and that number is $14.30. And so it's going to be, significantly less than that $5,000 in your area where you don't have a lot of large businesses. And so it'll be somewhere between those numbers, somewhere closer to the $1,400 than the $5,700, but I can't tell you the exact number. I think we can get that from Deed. And again, I would say, there's been tons and tons of studies about this and about the increasing the minimum wage and what the impact is. And the economists are pretty clear. Yes, there is a small increase in prices that gets passed on to all consumers. It's more in the range of 1% or a very small amount. It means when you go to have a hamburger or go to the local video store or go, to the whatever, the local's shop, you might pay a quarter more for something than you were paying before. But that's spread amongst all consumers, including consumers at all income levels. And the consequence is that you have thousands more people that you represent that are going to have a better shot at not living in poverty and at being able to pay for their heating bill and pay for their groceries and pay their rent or mortgage. And, you know, I think that's a pretty good trade-off. And that's, I think most Minnesotans support that trade-off. And that's why there's such strong statewide bipartisan support for raising the minimum wage. The other part of it is that there's the whole economic stimulus that comes from a minimum wage increase, because when you are making $6 an hour, every penny that you get in your paycheck gets spent within, you know, a very short time, because you need every penny of it just to live. And so all that money is being spent in that local community at those businesses. And so it will be recirculated, and it will help to create more job growth to help compensate if there's any detriment. So it really, that's why the economists say it really doesn't harm us.
Had almost an hour's discussion on this bill, and we're probably not going to change any votes. And there is a letter from the NFIB. Mr. Hickey, who was here earlier, couldn't make it, so just let you know that it's in your file. Senator Scoyt.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that Senate File Number 875 be recommended to pass and referred to the Senate floor.
Does it have to go? I believe to the floor.
To the floor.
Okay, on that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion does prevail.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee.
Senator Latz, do you have a... You know, we could use a non-controversial bill at this point.
Badly.
I know my two are, so, but...
Yeah.
Do you have your witnesses here?
My witness was sitting over here a moment ago. Can I check and see in the hallway if he stepped up? I'll give you a brief description of the bill while my accomplice is being sought.
Senator Latz, Senate File 1787.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, there is a delete all amendment that you have, the A1 amendment. I'd ask to I move that amendment, please, to put the bill in the shape I'd like to discuss it.
I guess we can accept that before we see it, to get it in the shape that the author would like it. Senator Latz moves the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. This bill arose because a number of the representatives of the railway workers have determined is that when they are injured on the job and they seek medical care, that they are being treated in terms of releases, authorizations, and disclosures back to the employers the same way that workers' compensation cases are being treated. However, railway workers are covered by federal law, and there is no requirement to send information back to the employers regarding a lot of this medical information. And so what this bill would do is simply require that the Commissioner of Labor and Industry send a communication, a notice, a reiteration that federal law applies here and that these are not workers' compensation cases and they should treat their disclosures accordingly. I do have Carl Knutson here with me on behalf of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters and the Soo Line Division of the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees, and ask to have him make a few comments.
Thank you, Mr.
Knutson. Welcome to the committee. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, and thank you, Senator Latz, for carrying this bill for us. The bill originally was in the rulemaking form. The original bill we took in front of the Workers' Comp Advisory Council, who advised us to work with the department. We did, and the language that we have here is the language that the parties agreed on. With the department is agreed on this language, and to my knowledge, there is no opposition to this bill. We'd appreciate your support.
Have all the Senator Latz Commissioner Labor and everybody has signed off on this and have agreed. Is that
yes.
correct?
They were here earlier at the earlier hearing, but okay, they decided not to come back.
Maybe we should ask if there's opposition to the legislation. Any further discussion of the members? Senator Murphy, would you like, or Senator Latz, I guess you can move your own bill.
I'd like to move that Senate file 1787 be recommended to pass and be referred, I believe, straight to the floor.
Floor, yeah. Consent calendar, if possible.
Consent calendar, if possible.
Don't push it.
Consent calendar is fine.
Is that fine? Republicans?
You want there?
Senator Rose and Senator Day, they're talking about a consent calendar on this site. I don't know.
It's fine. Consent calendar is great. That's a good place for it.
All right. Everybody apparently agrees, the departments do. But do you get a little nervous when Senator Latz... No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
Not everything
okay.
I do is...
Not everything. I'm just kidding. Okay, we're going to make that as part of Senator Latz's motion. Without objection. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson, we're going to go with yours.
Oh, here's his Best Buy deal again.
Senate File 1443, Northwest Airline Mechanics Unemployment Benefits.
Mr. Chair, I have a delete all amendment. It is the A6 amendment. And while that's being passed out, I can start. What this is to right a wrong.
Are we working, Senator Carlson, off the amendment or what?
Yes, we'll work off the amendment.
Okay.
Should we pass?
Should we move that to get it in the shape you'd like, and then we'll...
Sure. I move the A6 amendment.
And on the Carlson A6 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this is to right a wrong. It is something that has happened starting in about August of 2005 when there was a labor dispute and some people were... walked out, were locked out, laid off, and were treated differently than what they expected to be treated. What happened was that we had some people that were out of work. They were my constituents. Many of them worked for Northwest Airlines. They had very good jobs prior to leaving their jobs. They had to vote between cutting their pay in half and losing their job and just losing their job. So what happened was a lot of them did lose their jobs. I have door knocked a lot of these people, and so I know some of them personally. What I have here is a couple of people Ted Ludwig to testify, but I want to give you a little bit of background first and also read a testimony from a person that couldn't be here. What we had was this bill will... pay retroactive unemployment benefits to those that were eligible, and some of them that were it's going to extend the benefits for those that were also eligible, only for people that were eligible for unemployment because they missed work at the time of between August of 05 and August of 06. There is a requirement of making a biweekly filing with the with deed, and people called in, and because of the dispute, they were told not to call in anymore. And so some of them stopped calling in. Some of them called in for spite. Some of them got advice from other people, including some of their counsel from the union, and they called in. They continued to call in. They got their benefits. Some of them did not. Court of Appeals, there was an administrative law judge opinion that came out, and it found that these folks were not locked out and were not entitled to benefits
So they also stopped applying for benefits. That opinion was appealed, and the Court of Appeals reversed that opinion in September 2006. So at issue today is the reason for this legislation is that many of the technicians and inspectors were not given all of the unemployments that they were entitled. It cost them a lot of money out of their personal savings, their personal retirement, and they found themselves, some of them, and I'll read this statement to you, that were in terrible shape because they were not able to collect the money in time to save their homes. So what I have here is a statement from a Mr. Dean Bramstedt. It's fairly short. I'm going to read it to you. Mr. Chair, my name is Dean Bramstedt. I'm 46 years old. I've lived and paid taxes in Minnesota my whole life. Most of my working life, I worked for Northwest Airlines until my union, AMFA, was constructively locked out of work on August 19, 2005. Since August 19, 2005, I lost my job. I lost my house of 18 years and had to file bankruptcy. I've been forced to go back to college to get retrained. This was done at my expense with no help from the state. I'm attending Dakota County Technical College to attain my degree as a biomedical technician. I'm dipping into my retirement savings and the money that I had saved for my daughter's education to put myself through school. The people that are asking for the state's help through this bill were high wage earners, paying high taxes prior to losing their jobs, and they will be again someday. I'm here to ask your support for Senate File 1443 so we can all be productive taxpaying citizens of Minnesota again. Thank you. And this is from Mr. Dean Bramstedt. You may hear some information about precedent, and I want to read a few things about precedent here. In 1987, there was a statute, 268-125, that was enacted specifying certain conditions under which people could get extended benefits. And this would add more benefits other than the 26 weeks that were earned. In 1987, a payment was made, or a special legislation was passed, to give 339 Conwed workers 6 additional weeks. 1988, 467 Armour Foods workers 6 additional weeks. 1990, 526 Fairmont Food workers 6 additional weeks. 1994, 13 weeks. The statute was amended to provide 13 weeks of additional benefits under those conditions that the 87 statute was passed. 1994, payment was made to 511 National Steel pellet workers for 13 weeks. 1998, more legislation was passed suspending the mass layoff requirement, and there's a 10% unemployment rate in the county. All of those were suspended, and this was specifically to help the Hibbing taconite workers. 1997, there was a retroactive payment made to 18 Hibbing taconite workers for 13 weeks. 1997, 22 Bridges medical workers, 5 Best Foods workers for 13 additional weeks. In 2000, there were two separate laws suspending the mass layoff requirement and another requirement for county employment. 2000, payment was made to 11 Hennepin paper workers for 26 additional weeks. In 2000, payment was made to 53 Eveleth taconite workers for 13 additional weeks. 2001, the legislature passed extra benefits for LTV mining in Hoyt Lakes for 26 weeks. In 2002, Farmland Foods, Finger Hut companies, for up to 13 weeks of extra benefits. So there is precedent, Madam Chair, and this is something that I think is reasonable. Again, these were high-paying jobs. These were the kinds of people that keep the planes in the air. And one of the things some of you know that I like to talk about little details that no one else knows, something called ETOPS. And these are the people that worked on ETOPS. ETOPS, and I am a million-mile flyer, so I've done a lot of flying. Most of it has been on Northwest. When you fly overseas, there's a program of maintenance that goes on so that the engines don't stop. What you do is you make sure that the both engines or all three engines are maintained at the same time. ETOPS is a special program that allows one engine to be maintained at a time. And it has to be done with very high precision so that you don't lose an engine when you're flying overseas. And ETOPS actually stands for, in the industry, for engines turn or people swim. So these are the people that kept us flying. These are the people that I relied on when I flew. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Ted Ludwig, president of AMFA Local 33. He can testify on some of the other issues in the bill.
So first, Senator Carlson, on line 1.25, I understand that August 21st, 2006, should be changed to 2005. Would that sound correct to you? Of the A6 amendment. It's a typo. August 21st, 2006 should be August 21st, 2005.
Council Fuller says yes. Yes, that is correct.
All right. Excuse me. And you have to move that amendment if you'd like to just move that.
Yes, I move that that we correct that year.
That on 1.25 be changed to from 2006 to 2005. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Same sign and prevails. Okay, thank you. Mr. Ludwig.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for coming tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to speak. Thank you, committee members. The industry wording for ETOPS is not that, but he said that's what we say. That's what the mechanics say. It actually has a meaning that I don't even remember what that is anymore, but it's not engines stop turning, people swim. The situation that we are in with Northwest Airlines and their mechanics, cleaners, and custodians is who I represent, were that we had to make a choice between 53% of us voting to lose our job, and then the remaining 47% takes a 26% pay cut. That couldn't pass because nobody in their right mind would vote to lose their job. We have to have 50% plus one to ratify any contract, so that could never pass. And our membership decided that we would all just leave Northwest on August 19th, actually. And that was what we did. We went on strike. When we appealed for unemployment benefits, the department approved the unemployment benefits for part of our membership, which was the cleaners and custodians, but denied unemployment benefits for the technicians. And of course, we appealed that because we had the same company, the same union group, and the same strike situation, but yet the two groups were treated differently. And right off the bat, we didn't really think that was very fair. We appealed that decision. The administrative law judge held it to be true. So we appealed it to the Circuit Court of Appeals, and it took 1 year. So 1 year while we were on strike with Northwest Airlines, about 2,200 of us, probably 300 received benefits, and the rest of us were in an appeal process. And during this time, like Dean, I know Dean very well, during this time, we suffered pretty good. We had a lot of members that lost houses. I know south of the river there was mayors that had made comment to us about the amount of houses that were being lost. And when the Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that we should have been granted unemployment benefits because this was a constructive lockout. We just wondered, why couldn't this have happened when we had the constructive lockout 1 year prior? Because we were locked out of any kind of benefits, which is also the dislocated worker benefits, which would allow us to get some retraining or some help with resumes, give us access to the workforce centers. But we weren't even allowed to do that because we were denied unemployment, and it took a year for the process to work. So when the Court of Appeals came out and ruled that we were entitled to unemployment, then the department did not pay us all our unemployment that was due. They said, well, the majority of you didn't keep calling in every 2 weeks. There was 300 people that called in every 2 weeks for 26 weeks, but there was like 1,500 that didn't. And that's because we were led to believe that we were no longer supposed to call in. We were denied unemployment. The judge said we were denied unemployment. There's no way striking workers are going to get unemployment. So everyone stopped calling in. Well, after the Court of Appeals ruling came out, we were harmed for that because we didn't get paid for weeks we didn't call in. Even though we were instructed by the department not to call in any longer, they withheld those weeks of unemployment. And it was throwing salt in a wound, pretty much. That was not something we expected of our government. The one department that we reached out for help was really pretty much giving us a stiff arm. And I would say 99% of us have never asked the legislature for unemployment before. We've never taken money for unemployment because we've been employed. And the one time that we needed it, it wasn't there for us. So I would really like to see this wrong righted. These people that were told not to call in, I would like to see that, you know, they do get the unemployment that the Court of Appeals said that was due to them. And also, if people weren't able to find a job because they weren't allowed into the dislocated worker program for the next 6 months, if they didn't have work, it would be nice to have them get some unemployment benefits for that time too. Like Dean, he took money out of his retirement for his own schooling, and that'll never be made up. And if there is a chance for unemployment benefits, some people could make that up. And I think the number's going to be pretty small that this would actually affect. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions? Are there other people here to testify in favor or in opposition? And Mr. Nelson and Mr. Diedrichs, thank you for being here tonight.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I am the Director of Unemployment Insurance Legal Affairs for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I don't want to start off with a few remarks I want to do this, but I'll have to correct Mr. Ludwig. The Dislocated Worker Program, found in 116L.17, sets the criteria that you have to be permanently separated. So regardless of whether they would have been receiving unemployment benefits immediately by going on strike or not is not the criteria. Because there was still an active labor dispute going on, they would not have been entitled to dislocated worker services. They would have been entitled to dislocated worker services when they were made available, which is when they reached a contract with Northwest Airlines and they received layoff notices. At that point, they would be entitled to dislocated worker, and they were. So the dislocated worker program is a little bit of a non-issue here. This bill does three things. One of them has not been mentioned. What it does is was described earlier. When you apply for unemployment benefits, you fill out an application, and then each 2 weeks you're unemployed, you call in. We're going through the internet and basically say, I've been unemployed the last 2 weeks and I meet the requirements, you should pay me. That ongoing. But the first requirement is completing an application. What this bill does is backdate a number of those applications. That has never been done. The legislature has never provided for backdating of applications. The number of applications we're talking about here are probably 500. We're talking about a cost just on that backdating of applications, not the two-week calling in, which Mr. Ludwig referred to, a cost of about $1 million. That would affect some 500-some people.
over 600 people. 326 people waited 1 week after the strike to file. 109 waited 2 weeks. 46 waited 3 weeks. 38 waited 4 weeks. 31 waited 5 weeks. 49 waited 6 weeks to file, and on and on. And they would all be backdated under this bill, which has never been done before. That's not a call-in problem. That's just never went down to bother to fill out an application, which you do online or over the phone, which I believe the union had encouraged. And over 1,400 people did file right after the strike started. So that's what this bill does, which hasn't been described earlier. This bill does two other things, as was mentioned. One, the calling in problem where people didn't call in. And the department is not going to speak to that part unless I'm asked some questions. We don't particularly have any objection to that. The serious concern the department has is on the extension of 26 weeks. The department opposes and has opposed every extension going back to 1987, as the senator went through the history, which I earlier provided to him. And the reason for that is we simply don't feel that a single group should be chosen for extra benefits. Currently, over 12,000 people have exhausted their unemployment benefits since the start of the year. 1,000 people a week are exhausting their unemployment benefit entitlement. Over 80,000 people are currently collecting unemployment benefits in Minnesota, and 1,000 a week are running out, and there's no extension available to any of them. And we simply feel that, you know, single group shouldn't be picked out. This particular extension, while the history was going through, the most recent extensions have all had a training component. This one does not, for probably a variety of reasons, because it's all retroactive. The extension here is for a period of time prior to August 26th of 2006. So we're looking at benefits paid for periods before that. Some individuals under this bill would receive 52-week lump sum payment of over $26,000 in a single payment. The cost, as best we can estimate, gets a little difficult because we need to get our new system in place before we can do some really good numbers crunching. As best I can estimate, currently over 38,860 weeks of unemployment have been claimed and not paid because they didn't call in, or the person's already received all 26 of entitlement. You can keep calling in even after you've exhausted your entitlement. So as best we can estimate, the cost of the extension is going to be somewhere around $15 million for the extension, $13 to $15 million for the extension part. And that's already weeks already requested. That isn't, you know, the number dropped here of 100. They've already requested those weeks, certified they were unemployed during those weeks. That's the extension portion. It would be somewhere $13 to $15 million. And so, like I say, we have serious concerns that, you know, there are no extensions available for anyone else in the metro area. This legislation passes and some has pass out of this committee. No other persons in the state of Minnesota will receive that, and that's what the department has always questioned going back to 1987, why specific groups. And there are a lot of individuals in Minnesota who, I say, have exhausted entitlement and received nothing.
Okay, are there any questions? All right, Mr. Dietrichs.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I'll be brief because Mr. Nelson touched upon many of the points which I was going to bring up. Again, my name is Dave Dietrichs with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and thanks for the opportunity to talk about this bill. Again, similar to my testimony with Senator Murphy's electricians, unemployment insurance benefits extension, as well as the Ainsworth Lumber Company, the Chamber would just like to express its concern about the policy and precedent that a bill like this could offer. And then again, this bill, as Mr. Nelson indicated, is somewhat different than the prior two unemployment insurance benefits extensions that have been before this committee. We're concerned about the precedent this could set, particularly if there is an economic downturn, but most certainly we can anticipate that there will be future layoffs, and we're concerned about the health of the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Just a few things to reiterate what Mr. Nelson mentioned. We're concerned about the exclusivity provision in this bill, which allows for non-timely filing of applications for benefits. The length in this bill, the extension would be 26 additional weeks. That's beyond the normal 26 weeks of benefits that are usually granted in cases like this. I should say that normally 13 weeks of extra benefits are granted. I believe in the entire list that Senator Carlson read out earlier, there were two cases that involved 26 weeks of benefits extensions. In one of those, I believe the LTV case, the employer was officially bankrupt, so those were some different circumstances there. Mr. Nelson didn't mention this, but currently the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund is at approximately $235 million. That's over $1.2 billion below what's recommended by the United States Department of Labor, as well as an audit that was done by the Minnesota Legislative Office of the Legislative Auditor. We're also concerned about the retroactivity provision that Mr. Nelson mentioned. We should also finally just state that, again, we're only believe that extending benefits should be limited to 13 weeks and only granted if not available from the federal government. So for several reasons, we are concerned about this bill, particularly the precedent it could set leading into the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Diederichs. Are there other questions?
Madam Chair, I have an amendment to offer.
Okay. Senator Scheid has an
amendment.
A7. The A7 amendment.
And I did discuss it briefly with Senator Carlson earlier today. And I think it's something the department would support and will speak to, because I think that some injustice was done and I don't think it was intended to be an injustice, but I think it turned out to be one given the Court of Appeals. I think that's the point at which things were turned around and the ruling was in favor of the workers, I believe. And so this would provide unemployment benefits to those people that you heard mentioned who did not keep calling in because they were led to believe they didn't, they shouldn't do it anymore. And so obviously some people got discouraged by that, the appeals process, just gave up. I think it makes those people whole, gives them what they would have been entitled to under current law. I've been told it doesn't give them more than under current law, and it doesn't do an extension. But I think that it probably covers about something over 1,000, probably about 1,300 workers, and the cost on it is about $3 to $5 million in benefits. But frankly, I would be concerned about the bill going on its own and being successful at the end of the day. And I think that this is something that has an opportunity to become law and is probably a responsible thing to do.
Okay, Senator Scheid moves the A7 amendment. Is there other discussion or testimony on the A7 amendment? Yes, Mr. Ludwig.
I understand what you're, Madam Chair, Senator. I understand exactly what you mean by this, but I would be doing our membership a disservice if I didn't bring this up. So, please bear with me. This amendment says Deed should have done what they should have done 18 months ago. It says you guys should have, you know, paid these guys unemployment benefits 18 months ago when they applied. That to me is a real disservice because those benefits have already been used. They're already gone. They shouldn't figure into the unemployment account that everyone talks about is disappearing. These were, that was something that we needed then, and that's what this amendment does. Also, and I understand about what will pass and what will not pass. I really do understand that. The legislature and the state of Minnesota has a contract with Northwest Airlines. Many of you maybe have been involved with that, or many of you maybe have voted on that. And in that contract, it said, we'll give you money. We'll give Northwest Airlines money for jobs. And Northwest got the money. They got a hangar up in Duluth that's empty. And the state didn't get the jobs. And when we lost 1,683 workers on March 23rd of 2003, Northwest wasn't held accountable. And when we lost another 2,200 on August 21st, Northwest wasn't held accountable. The state has the opportunity to force Northwest Airlines to employ 17,000 people here. They've never done that. They have the opportunity and the power to have the Duluth hangar opened up and employ 350 people there. It's in the state contract with Northwest Airlines. And the legislature has never, ever held Northwest accountable to this contract. And it seems like the only people that are going to suffer from this are the workers. And I think that's a very, very horrible thing to do to people that have worked there for 30 years. If you can't help them get back on their feet, but you're willing to help a multi-million-dollar corporation that has mechanics jobs in China and Singapore, I can't explain that to our membership. I don't know how you would like me to explain that to our members, that the legislature will help the corporation, but they won't help the workers. And we're the ones that vote for people to come here. The corporation never does. We need help from our legislatures as people. And we don't feel that we're getting that. But I understand what you say, Senator, about passing, and I want to make those comments. Thank you.
Okay. Are there other comments? Senator Rosen.
Mr. Logan, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I disagree with that. It's that the department is saying that they should have your analysis of this amendment. I think it's a very generous amendment. My question is, how many of the workers did not call in? How many of them stopped calling in? Do you know? Was it 300? Was it 500? A few?
It was the majority. 300 called in all the way through. There was 2,200 eligible, and I think 1,700 applications, so 1,400 stopped calling.
Madam Chair. Mr. Ludwig, did you receive a letter from the department, or did you get information from the union that it's not worth calling in?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, the department sent out letters, and on every newspaper that came out, they said there's no unemployment. Guys who did call in brought in their papers that said ineligible, you're on strike. That came right from Deed. We called the customer service line at Deed, and they said, well, you guys are on strike. Striking workers don't get unemployment. There's no need for you to call in. The union told our members in an update that continue to call in, and because we don't know about the unemployment system, like I said, none of us had ever done it before, and the union did that to just basically cover our behinds. I myself stopped calling in when I was told, you don't need to call in anymore. And I was told in my hearing, my objection to that, that I should have known better because I'm the union president. And I don't know if union presidents claim unemployment benefits a lot or what, but
I have never done this before. I didn't know how this worked. So we were led to believe that we didn't need to call him anymore.
But, Madam Chair and Mr. Lode, you are assuming some responsibility for not telling your members to continue to call in, even though you were referred to not to call in. Is that or say?
We did make an update that said keep calling in. But we aren't the ones that govern unemployment. You know, the department was telling our members not to. The union was telling you should keep calling in. But like I said, that was just to cover the unions behind. We don't govern unemployment, and we don't know the system. We did that just to cover.
Okay, sir, a response to Mr. Nelson. Do you have anything to comment on that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I guess I would take issue with it. They were told not to call in. I'll even make a comment when Mr. Ludwig indicates he was told not to call in. That's not what he testified during the course of his hearing under oath, but that's kind of a matter of matter. I will admit there's no doubt people got discouraged. They're told you're ineligible. You know, you're ineligible while you're on strike. The unemployment law judge's decision says right at the bottom, keep calling in. It's posted on the union website. The union lawyers told everybody to keep calling in. The union was encouraging people to keep calling in, as I said. But that was the requirement. And I have no doubt people called in and were probably discouraged. Told don't bother, I would take strong issue with that. But no doubt got discouraged because the process and the appeals process takes a long time. That's not unique. Just got finished with a case just a few weeks ago in which it took 2 years, ultimately, for the Minnesota Supreme Court to overrule everyone else down below, including the Court of Appeals, and the woman prevailed. And so that's the process. Unfortunately, the process in the Court of Appeals took about 10 months to get a decision from the Court of Appeals. And no doubt that's a discouraging process. And that's why we are not opposing the amendment offered by Senator Scheid, as I indicated earlier. That's not to say we support it or endorse it, but we do not oppose it.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know we have the amendment before us, which I will support. But I do want to make a comment, and I don't know if I think I've mentioned it in other committees in the past, but this is a new committee, and we are dealing with unions and quite a bit of union legislation. And I actually was raised in a union family in Colorado, and my dad was an industrial insulator for 38 years. And we lived by the union. We lived by strikes. We lived by the deals that the unions made. That's how our life was. And there was many times when my father didn't have a job, and he dealt with asbestos every day. And he died at 65 from mesothelioma. And I understand the entire issue about unions and the deals you make and how you want to protect each other and your jobs. I understand that better than anybody, probably, because I lived and breathed it and lost a father because of it. But I'm really concerned about the fund. I'm really concerned about the precedents that we're setting with this legislation and that there isn't going to be anything left for anybody else who loses his job. And I really think we're going down the wrong path with this piece of legislation. I think this is a very generous amendment, and I fully support it.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. Any other discussion? All right, on the shy.
Chair, yes. I guess I need to make a couple of comments about the, you know, one thing about the fund. We had worked with some of the folks here that objected to using these claims in calculation of Northwest's rates. If we would do that, they would be replenishing the fund because their rates would go up. So we decided to be somewhat cooperative with that to not have Northwest's rates go up. And as a matter of, I believe the fund is replenished by rulemaking. It is in, you know, the rates will be increased by rulemaking when it gets done. And that's not these people's responsibility. They were the ones that lost their jobs from high-paying jobs and got nothing for quite some time. And then some of them
got a little bit, but most of them lost large amounts, and many of them had to wait a long time for this to be fixed. They had very good jobs, very high-paying jobs, and they were cut off instantly. And now anyone that has a high-paying job and gets cut off instantly, it takes a while to get back on your feet to a new level of spending. And that's what happened here is these folks lost a lot.
Okay, Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, but Senator Carlson, that was the decision by the union, and the union is they all follow underneath that decision. So even though 47% or 45% did not agree with that decision, it was still a union decision to go on strike, and that you have to follow with that decision that was made, whether you agree with it or not. So my question to you, Senator Carlson, who's going to replace is it just Northwest Airline workers or the entire state?
Okay.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I think probably Mr. Nelson could be very precise on how it gets replaced, but unemployment benefits, I think you're in business, you know that you pay unemployment benefits based on your history. And in this particular case, we're not charging Northwest with that history. That will go on to it'll be spread against everyone. And that's why the Chamber of Commerce is not very happy about this being a precedent, because it gets spread against all employers in the state.
Right.
So that's correct.
And other...
And I guess I need to...
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, go back a little bit more, too. And yes, it was a decision by the members, but I thought we made that a little bit clearer, is that this was not a decision that was necessarily on an employment contract. This was on a lockout. And we did need to go back just a little bit on what had happened in the meantime here. Northwest Airlines was given major concessions, millions and millions of dollars, a $270 million loan from the MAC. $800 million was appropriated by the legislature. It was cut back to 700 and some. I have the numbers in here. But so there's major concessions that were given to that employer, and that employer had an agenda to set this up so that these people had no choice but to vote to go on strike. They had no choice. And this is it is something that you can do as an employer, is you can set it up so that you force a union to vote that way. And I'm sure that Mr. Ludwig had some very tough choices there to make when he told his people to vote to go on strike. So there's a lot that went on in the background here, and it did involve that employer.
Okay, I think we'll vote on the SHIDE A7 amendment. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign?
No.
I need a division. Sorry, my ears aren't very good. All those in favor? 4, 5, 6. Okay. And all those opposed? 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's tied, so it... And Senator Carlson?
I'm sorry. Yep.
So you're voting for or against...
Opposed.
Opposed. So the amendment fails. All right. Should we go back to the original bill? Is there any... The A6 amendment.
Bill as amended.
Yes.
Yes.
Any other discussion on the A6 amendment?
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Tomasoni.
Senator Fuller, can you explain the amendment I want to do?
It's a good one.
It's on line 2.7 of the A6 amendment. After the period, insert regular and. And what that does is it just says that the benefits that will be paid in this bill won't be charged back to Northwest Airlines. Is that correct? Did I explain that right?
So, Mr. Fuller, would you mind explaining that to us, what that means? I would appreciate that.
Believe me?
Or Mr. or
No, that's not necessary.
I believe it.
Or Senator Tomasoni, if you would like to,
that
would
be. Go ahead, counsel. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, ordinarily when benefits are paid because of your employees receiving, you charge back, your experience rating is charged. This will not do that. So what they say is these costs are socialized. They'll be assumed by the whole system, you know, so they won't be charged against the particular employer whose employees were laid off and paid back through their tax on the experience rating. It's possible they could be maxed out and there wouldn't be a total reimbursement, but that's in general describes what happens.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, may I ask what the cost to the fund is? I think maybe we were told. I just don't know for sure if Senator Carlson knows or if Mr. Nelson knows what the cost is then to the fund.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, at this point, Nelson here has a max number, but at this point we don't know how many people were actually unemployed in that extended benefit time. If you're looking for a max number, I think we have that. But if you're looking for the actual number, that's going to be something that'll have to be largely, you know, after a notice is given to those folks, because I don't think we have a number of people that were unemployed between 05 and 06.
Madam Chair, if I might ask Mr. Nelson then.
Yes, you may ask Mr. Nelson. Senator Scheid, Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, as I previously indicated, it's fairly complex, but people have already called in and requested benefits. 38,380 weeks. And it comes to $500 a week. So they've already requested those payments, and they have not been paid either because they didn't call in on a timely basis or they've already collected 26 weeks' worth. But they have, in fact, requested then. Some people have already requested 52 and only been paid for 26. So they are 38,380 certifications. They were unemployed. And that's $500 a week, and all you do is take the math out, and that comes to $20 million. That has already been requested. The bill could, in fact, go past that because there could be more people coming in later. But we already know this bill is $20 million. And I didn't hear the previous amendment. I will apologize.
It would charge the regular and extra benefits to the fund as opposed to, and it's on line 2.7, after the period, after fund, insert regular and extra benefits paid under this session shall not be used in computing the experience rating of Northwest Airlines.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, I think you'd be in violation of federal law. I believe you have to charge regular benefits to Northwest Airlines. You can excuse them from being charged extra benefits, but I believe under federal law you'd be required to. I think we'd be in violation of federal law, and it would automatically be stricken. It's interesting whether the statute, which currently provides for an automatic striking of any law, would do that.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nelson, did. How do we do it with Ainsworth?
I don't think you have to do anything to the bill as I read it. I think you just leave it the way it is. I don't know why it says extra benefits under the section shall not be used in computing regular benefits. You don't have to say anything about regular benefits. They're automatically charged.
So, Senator Tomasoni, you had a question about another situation.
Yeah. How do we do it with Ainsworth?
How do we do it with Ainsworth?
Yeah.
The last version did not charge Ainsworth, but that's strictly an extension.
So the language we have in the bill is the same as we did with Ainsworth without my amendment?
Mr. Nelson.
Yes. Okay, I'll withdraw that amendment then.
Okay, the Tomasoni amendment has been withdrawn. And so essentially what I understand is that of the $20 million, the regular benefits will be charged to Northwest Airlines.
Yes, Madam Chair, that would amount to somewhere under this current bill, it's going to somewhere around 3 to 5 million will be charged to Northwest Airlines. The remainder of that, somewhere in the area of $15 million, will be pooled cost to the all employers in the state of Minnesota.
And those be, and that's because it's extra benefits beyond. Okay, very good. Any other discussion on the A6 amendment? All right. If there's no more discussion, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign.
No.
Okay, I want to just say division. All right. All those in favor of the amendment, please raise your hand.
Amendment.
I'm sorry, the bill.
The bill
which
as amended.
Which was the A6, which was the language in the A6 amendment.
Bill as amended.
Okay, should we do that again? We are now going to take a vote on the bill as amended, Senate File 1443. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And opposed, same sign.
No.
Okay, division. All those in favor, please hold, please raise your hand.
This is the.
And all those opposed, same sign.
I'm with you.
Okay, the motion does not pass. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
What's the next bill we got?
Metzen bill.
Let's see what we can do to him.
Should I leave now, or you want to?
All right, your excuse.
Right. Our next bill is Senator Metzen with Senate File 1278, the Best Value Procurement Procedure.
I don't know this one.
So
thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Let me start by saying this is not only a labor bill. This legislation has been agreed with the cities, counties, townships, school districts, and other public entities. It's called the Best Value Contracting Construction Project legislation. The Best Value is a system that takes both price and performance into consideration when construction contracts are awarded. This does not replace the low bid system, but instead would provide for Best Value as another option for these jurisdictions. So it's not mandated. It's an option. It gives the school districts, the counties, the cities, other jurisdictions to go on the look at a best value situation, not only the low bid. And again, if you're one of these jurisdictions, you do not have to do this. So you've got the option. Some people say that the best value would provide the best long-term deal on a construction project for Minnesota taxpayers, not just the price that seems to be the cheapest up front. We've logged many hours on this as stakeholders, including state agencies, labor contractors, the League of Cities, the Associated Minnesota Counties, and they've met over the course of several months looking at this best value contracting option. The University of Minnesota has done this maybe 13 to 16 times. They like it. They've done it successfully, and it has worked very well for the University of Minnesota. I believe the state of Hawaii has used this and maybe other some jurisdictions. And thirdly, it benefits Minnesota workers because best value creates a system that rewards skilled training personnel. We have A2 amendment that addresses the concerns of contractors and agreement between them and the cities, and I understand the Department of Administration has signed off, so maybe we want to look at the A2 amendment. But an A2 deals with the training and some schooling and apparently it deals with the commissioners. We establish a training program for state and local officials. But I want to leave with the committee one last thought, and I mentioned it twice already, but this is not compulsive. You don't have to do it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say that for the fourth time. It's optional. So if you're worried about this is a labor thing or it's somebody else's thing, again, it's supported by the municipalities and all the local government officials. And again, if you're nervous, tell your city councils and mayors and what have you, don't do it. So anyway, we have the A2 amendment that.
So do you all have the A2 amendment in front of you?
I guess it deals with training. So.
All right, Senator Murphy, do you have a comment on A2, or should we?
No, I was ready to vote on the
ready
A2.
Ready to vote? Okay. If all those in favor of the A2, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign, and motion prevails. All right.
Does Senator Metzen need a motion to move?
Is there? You can. Well, he can move his own bill.
That's fine. I'd like Senator Murphy.
Senator Murphy would like to move the bill, and then we'll have discussion. Senator Murphy, would you like to move the?
Do it.
Dick Day is not allowed to.
No, he was going
to
do it.
Senator Day would like to move this.
Yeah.
Would you like to move
I'm sure his local.
Madam Chair, I would love to move this bill.
I'm sure his locals have talked
would
to
love
him.
Love Senator Murphy. I'm sorry.
Oh, would you, Senator Murphy?
I want Senator
special
Day to
day
move.
Day when Senator Day moves Senator Metzen's bill. So Senate File 1278 as amended. All right. Is there any other discussion? Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails. And this will be going, I didn't say, this will be going to straight to the floor?
I'm sure the consent calendar. It'll go to the floor.
Okay. Very good.
What is this best value thing?
Oh, that's for you.
That's what we just did.
Oh, that's what we did?
Yeah. Metzen's next.
Okay. Our next bill is Senator Metzen.
Yeah, I think we're
File 2212, Social Security Unemployment Offset Provisions Modified.
Do we have a delete all amendments?
Okay.
Apparently we have a delete all amendment.
All right. We'll start with the delete all amendment on Senate File
Senator Day
2212.
Senator Rosen, I think, wants to move that amendment to get rid of it.
Whatever it is.
Yeah.
Can't do that.
So you guys aren't surprised.
Something going on?
All right. Let's move the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign, and the motion prevails. All right, on the A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 2212 deals with Social Security offset. This bill was brought to me by the ARP of Minnesota. Skip Humphrey and others have contacted me. Apparently, we're one out of only eight states that has not done this offset. According to deeds, the records about 4,000 Minnesotans are affected each year. People at work, despite their drawing Social Security, depend on these wages. I'm going to have Mr. Nelson kind of go through it a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson, for being here tonight again.
We have a copy of the
Mr. Nelson needs a copy of the A1 amendment, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think I can speak to it.
Mature.
this bill, and I'm sure each of the members has had these issues been raised by their constituents for years. I should point out that Minnesota has had a deduction for Social Security since 1936, the beginning of the program. This is not a new law. This is nothing. And there has been a change slowly across the country where other states have been not doing a offset, a deduction, if you will. I just today looked into a case for one of the members here about a person who was just laid off a few weeks ago from MDI. He is a disabled individual collecting Social Security disability. He's been working at MDI for years and was laid off. He made $8,000 a year at MDI. He gets Social Security disability, gets a little over $940 a month in Social Security disability. Under current law, there is a 50% offset of his Social Security against any unemployment benefits. So $113 a week of Social Security is deducted from his unemployment benefit amount. But his unemployment benefit amount is only $103, so he received nothing, even though he worked at MDI for years and has now been laid off. Because he collects that Social Security disability, this bill would impact that individual. He would not have that Social Security offset. What this bill does is say, if you have worked and collected Social Security and are then laid off, there is no deduction. But if you have not demonstrated that you're a member of the workforce while collecting Social Security, then there is a 50% offset. The current offset stays in place, except for those individuals who, in fact, have worked and collected Social Security and then are laid off. We think this is going to impact positively about 4,000 individuals. Most of these individuals don't receive very much in Social Security and receive even much smaller amounts in unemployment benefits. I think in your handout there's an individual, she was here this afternoon but not here tonight, who receives $6 a week in unemployment benefits because of the offset of Social Security. And she only receives $500-some a month in Social Security. So, as I say, we do not officially take a position on this bill, but we worked with AARP over the months through the encouragement of Senator Metzen. Keep working with them. The commissioner has told me to keep working with them, and we finally came up with something everybody can accept. All the interest groups, and that's the bill you have before you. We think it's a good bill.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. And Senator Tomasoni moves the bill. Any other discussion? Anyone here to testify?
Madam Chair, I just have a question.
And Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nelson, did that person end up losing that hundred and some dollars then of Social Security, or they just kept receiving their Social Security and no unemployment?
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, they would keep receiving their Social Security, but simply no unemployment benefits.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. All those in favor of Senate File 2212 as amended, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign, and motion prevails.
Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
And Senator Scalia.
Madam Chair, I would move that the committee reconsider Senate File number 1443. I think Senator Carlson would like to reconsider a vote that was made.
Okay. Very good. Sure. Senator Carlson?
Well, we need to vote on the reconsideration.
All those in favor. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Okay, motion prevails. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we've had some discussions here, and what I'd like to do is reconsider the Scheid Amendment.
The A7 Amendment.
The A7 Amendment, yes.
All right.
I move to reconsider the A7 Amendment.
We don't have to move that. Okay. It's already been moved. All right. Would somebody move? He has moved it. Okay, we have now moved the A7 Amendment back into discussion. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails. All right.
Madam Chair, I'd like to remove Senate File 1443 as amended with
We need to vote on
A6 and the A7 amendments were in place. A6 was the original amendment. A7 amends A6.
Should I just delete all?
Okay, I believe that the A7 is a delete all amendment.
That's your bill now.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
So I think we just want to look at the A7 amendment, which we adopted.
Right, that's correct, yes.
So is there any other discussion on the A7 amendment?
We just adopted it.
It's actually on the Senate file.
Okay, it's on the Senate file. Okay. Any other discussion, Senator Carlson?
Let's see what happens.
No.
No.
All those in favor of passing?
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Rosen.
Does everybody at this table, Madam Chair, feel as uncomfortable about it as I do, about this reconsideration? We've dealt with this on the floor several times, and now we're seeing it in committee. I just have to state that for the record. I'm amazed. I'm a little amazed.
Madam Chair. Madam Chairman, and Senator Rosen, it's not unusual for someone to
use
a bill in committee and take a little bit of extra time because it appeared that the Scheid amendment had some momentum, take a little bit of time, reconsider what was going on, and then reconsider the whole bill. That's not unusual. We do that all
right.
The time. And if my ears weren't failing me earlier, I believe that you voted for the A7 amendment.
Madam Chairman,
and if that's the case, that's what we have in front of us now is the A7 amendment that is now Senator Carlson's 1443. So
and
nothing
Madam
unusual
Chair,
about that.
Okay, in response to that, Senator Murphy, I did vote for the amendment. And I know I'm new here. My only fifth session here. I have never been in a committee where we've reconsidered a bill in the same committee at the same time. So perhaps this is common occurrence, but it is a little new to me. And I'm just saying that it's uncomfortable. I have the right to say that I'm uncomfortable.
Absolutely. All right. Any
Madam
other?
Chair, Rosen, I hope I wasn't part of your discomfort.
Madam Chair, I would hope that Senator Rosen would vote for this.
Senator Thomas,
last time.
Okay. So just to clarify, we are now voting on Senate File 1443 as amended with the A7 amendment. Okay. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
And the motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
And the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everyone.
Thank God.